robots, they are not what they used to be.
Before recently, we had to program robots to do specific things. We had to give them specific instructions.
Now they can learn new skills with trial and error. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, why huge advances in robotics are exciting for some and scary for others. Also, in Mali, militant groups are gaining ground. We'll break down the players and their alliances.
Plus, it looks like a breakthrough in plastic recycling, but it may not be so easy.
We as an industry were too quick to claim the solution to the problem.
Plus, what makes a marmalade great?
There's an X factor, so you just have no idea when you open the jars what's going to happen.
Find out with us today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for coming along this Tuesday. Flags are at half-staff in Mali as the West African nation observes a second day of mourning. This after an unexpected attack on the capital, Bamako, on Sunday. The country's defense minister, Assadio Camara, was among the dead.
Un deuil national de deux jours, à compter du lundi 27 avril à 0h.
A spokesman for Mali's ruling military junta announced the period of mourning for the fallen defense minister on Mali's state broadcaster.
En hommage au général Sadio Camara.
The violence in Mali right now represents an existential fight for the government there as Al-Qaeda-linked jihadists and Tuareg separatists gain ground. Today, these allied militant forces claim control of the northeastern Malian city of Kidal. But it is a complicated picture, so we turned to Ulf Lessing. He's a security analyst with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation, based in Bamako. When we caught up with him today in Cairo, he explained that going back to Bamako now is not an option.
Right now, I can't. The German government, as other countries, have asked their citizens to leave. For the time being, it's shaky. I think it's somewhat returning, but there seems to be still some pockets of fighting around Bamako Airport. I hope things will improve, but we also need a sign of life from the military leader, Goita.
Yeah, Goita, he is the president of the country, correct?
Yeah, exactly. He's the one who staged the coup in 2020 and then has now appointed himself for another 5 years in power. Nobody has seen him since the attack. The defense minister was killed. Goita, nobody has seen. I assume he's hiding. I mean, the fact that they really hit defense minister in a position strike, no, someone has given the rebels from inside the system coordinates. So that's why I think Goita now, he keeps really a low profile, hiding for now until this situation is under control again.
So following the coup in 2021 that brought the military junta to power, they kicked out French and UN security forces that were supporting the previous government. We've got this Russian military group, Africa Corps. They have left Kidal. Elaborate a bit more on what this current instability says about the effectiveness of the military junta.
They were kind of desperate for outside help, but made the wrong bet. They brought in the Russian mercenaries, which claimed they could, do a better job than the French. I mean, France had for 10 years counterterrorism operation. They also weren't successful, but that is because the nature of Mali is such a vast country, mostly desert and, mountains. It's very difficult to control. The French had maybe like 5,000-6,000 soldiers here, and the Russians came with around 1,500. So they was really wrong expectation. They oversold the Russians, their pitch. They never stood a chance. And at the end, it's now also a bit of it's a complete wrong calculation by the military government and a defeat for Russia, which promised too much.
Do you have any sense of where Mali's military junta can now turn for military assistance to fight these two groups?
Yeah, there's not much left. The Europeans are gone. The French are gone. I mean, interestingly, under the Trump administration, the U.S. sent a couple of visitors and offered counterterrorism assistance. Nothing has come out of it, also because the Malians were a bit lukewarm. That was a few months ago when they still thought the Russians would help them. So now maybe they're a bit more open to some kind of cooperation, but I expect whatever the U.S. would have to offer would be some kind of maybe intelligence sharing. They wouldn't put boots on the ground, so yeah, the U.S. is pretty much the only option, very limited one. And then there's Turkey, who is certainly willing to sell more drones, but they also don't work for free, so these drones are really expensive. Not sure that is another good option.
On Sunday, the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, issued a statement calling for, quote, all states security forces, regional mechanisms, and populations of West Africa to unite and mobilize in a coordinated effort to respond to the attacks in Mali. Mali, let's remember, withdrew from ECOWAS recently. So what can ECOWAS actually do here to intervene?
Yeah, basically nothing. Mali, together with Niger and Burkina Faso, the neighbors, which are also run by the military left, ECOWAS. So I think ECOWAS, it's a way of them to saying, we're open to cooperate with you guys. I mean, there's a bit of cooperation with some ECOWAS members, such as Ghana, together with Burkina Faso, which also has a jihadist problem. So yeah, if there's a bit of more cooperation, such as intelligence sharing and securing borders, that might help. But yeah, on the other day, ECOWAS can't also solve this security mess with Mali has become, you know, such a vast country nobody can really control.
There's long been concern across West Africa about the spread of jihadist militancy further south into places like northern Ghana, northern Togo, northern Cote d'Ivoire. Where do those concerns sit today after this attack on Bamako?
Yeah, we had the same group that's now, I mean, attacking Bamako is already in Benin.
Benin, right next to Nigeria.
Exactly. And also Nigeria has lots of jihadist activity, most recently attacks, not just in the north, also in western Nigeria, Kwara state bordering Benin. So that's a real concern that Mali collapse turns into this big retreat base for jihadists planned from there. Then the next step, you know, I mean, pushing also in Ghana, Togo, and yeah, possibly Senegal. That's the huge concern, yeah.
Where does all this leave the people of Mali, and especially people in the capital, Bamako?
Yeah, people are really suffering. Even before that, you know, when I was still there, there was very little electricity because, like you mentioned, the fuel supplies are being disrupted by jihadists, and electricity is mainly powered by generators. So life has been tough on people, and, you know, yeah, 300,000 Malians are living in refugee camps in neighbor Mauritania. And I expect if instability also spreads to this house, then more people will try to leave.
Ouf Lessing is a Bamako-based security analyst. And now for a quick look at some of the day's other headlines, starting with tech news from Australia.
The Australian government has just released draft legislation proposing a new tax on Meta, Google, and TikTok. The tax would help support journalism across Australia. It is an attempt to make digital giants pay for the news users find through their sites. Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said platforms should not be able to peddle content without compensating the people who create it. We think that investment in journalism is critical to a healthy democracy, he added. Meta and Google oppose the tax. No comment so far from TikTok.
In Sri Lanka, police arrested 22 Buddhist monks at the airport. The monks were heading back from a four-day trip to Thailand when authorities found a potent strain of high-grade cannabis hidden in their luggage, and no small amount. We're talking more than 200 pounds of cannabis, valued at more than $3 million. According to a police spokesperson, there was one monk who organized a trip but did not go along, and he told those who went to Thailand that the parcels they'd collected were a donation.
Finally, in the days when dinosaurs roamed on land, a giant carnivorous ancestor of the octopus swam the seas alongside the better-known sea reptiles and pointy-toothed sharks of the Cretaceous era. That is according to a new analysis of fossilized jaws of this octopus ancestor found in Japan and on Vancouver Island in Canada. Scratches and chips on the jaws and teeth suggest the animals repeatedly crushed shells and bones. That study was published late last week in the journal Science.
And those are a few headlines you might have missed. One year ago today, the light suddenly went out in Spain and Portugal, a total blackout, the worst Europe had seen in two decades. In some areas, full power was not restored until nearly a day later. Fortunately, widespread panic did not set in, although it's safe to say nerves from Lisbon to Barcelona were frayed. The World's Jerry Haddon reported shortly after the blackout about one tiny town in northeast Spain that was able to keep the lights on.
At about 12:30 p.m. on the day Spain went dark, the 197 residents of San Vicente del Monte in Spain's north noticed flickering lights. But it only lasted about 5 seconds, one unidentified resident told a local TV station the next day. Getting to town and finding all the lights on, said another resident, I was just in shock. The power was out everywhere except for here. The power stayed on in San Vicente because of a lithium battery about the size of a file cabinet in a green metal container. It had just been sitting there outside, nearly forgotten on the edge of the village, for 4 years. Mayor Lorenzo González recalls how a local energy company called Viesco showed up in 2021 looking for someone to give it a try.
Y me dicen, oye, que queríamos sacarlo adelante, pero somos incapaces, que no nos dejan colocarlo en ningún sitio.
They said, look, we've been asking all over to set up this experimental battery, but no one's game. I told them, look, if you paint the container thing green so it blends in with the trees, then no problem. That could be the battery's nickname, no problem, because during the blackout, the village had none. The battery was supposed to last for 3 to 4 hours, said that first unnamed resident on TV. But the blackout lasted more than 7 hours, he said, and we never lost juice. All eyes have been on the village since, and not just for being the only place in Iberia for 7 long hours where you could charge your smartphone. Turns out that the little battery that could be part of a plan to avoid another energy catastrophe. But before the possible fixes, first, what went wrong?
Muy probablemente en la red había demasiada energía.
Spanish scientist and energy grid expert Antonio Curiel says there was most likely too much energy in the grid, which can set sparks flying if not addressed. Pinpointing exactly where the breakdown began will probably take months. In the meantime, the question of why the problem wasn't contained, why the whole country lost power, is causing heated debate. A lot of it zeroing in on renewable energy.
En ese momento tienes un 53% de generación fotovoltaica.
Turiel says that when the blackout hit, renewables, that is, solar and wind, were producing nearly two-thirds of Spain's electricity. When everything's working, explains Turiel, when the grid's in sync and supply and demand are perfectly matched, then renewables are wonderful. But if something unexpected happens, say a windstorm causes a spike in energy production,
mientras había pocos sistemas volcando electricidad a la red, no pasaba nada porque el resto de sistemas sí que tenían capacidad de flexibilidad.
If renewables are just a small part of the energy puzzle, says Turiel, then the traditional systems can adapt and absorb fluctuations. The problem is when renewables are producing the lion's share of electricity and then something goes wrong. That's because renewables can't adapt as quickly as traditional energy sources like gas or hydropower. And since the big blackout on April 30th, that's been getting a lot of attention. But Turiel says beating up on renewables is unfair. Scientists have been warning the European Union for years, he says. You can't just roll out renewable energy without also creating a system to keep it stable.
Tienes una legislación europea que por tal de favorecer una rápida expansión de los sistemas renovables.
We've got these European directives to expand renewables fast, he says. So the EU made lax rules around safety systems. He's talking about systems like maybe a whole network of batteries like the one in San Vicente del Monte. Linked together, they could quickly absorb excess energy or release it during shortfalls. The reason the EU hasn't made this part of the green energy push?
Si tú pones todos los sistemas de estabilización, ya no es en absoluto, ni de lejos.
Because our cheap renewables would end up costing more than gas or coal, says Turiel, once you add in all the necessary infrastructure. For now, no one's willing to pay for it, at least not on a large scale.
Sí, nosotros si Viesgo quiere colocarla, le dejo colocarla en todos los municipios, en todos los pedanías.
San Vicente Mayor Lorenzo González told local TV recently he'd happily sign off on thousands of batteries set up all across his region in Spain's north. Then again, he got his battery for free. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
A year later, authorities say the outage had multiple causes. Not enough emergency batteries like the one we just heard about, unusual surges and drops in electricity output, and a lack of connectedness to the rest of Europe. That would have given the massive electrical surge somewhere to go. The Spanish government promised to increase oversight and control of the grid, but that proposal stalled in Congress. Work has begun, though, on an undersea power cable linking Spain to the grid in neighboring France and beyond. It's supposed to be fully operational by 2028. You're with The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The robot news has been coming fast and furious this month. One robot won a half marathon in Beijing. Others captured a Russian position on the battlefield in Ukraine. And last week, we learned of a robotic arm that beat table tennis champions at their own game. That example in particular showcases a new ability to react and adapt to an unpredictable world in real time. Kenne Mbanisi is an assistant professor of robotics engineering at Olin College in Massachusetts. He says this latest advance in robotics is impressive for several reasons.
It is definitely a super cool factor. But beyond the cool factor, it demonstrates that robots can interact in the physical world in ways that humans can, and not just humans, but elite humans with very high levels of skill and capabilities. So that's very exciting.
Tell me more about that interacting with humans. I understand that something that's hard about robotics is getting robots to react properly when something unpredictable happens. Is that kind of the crux of why this is so interesting, this table tennis example?
Yes. So I'll say that what makes this particularly exciting is that this demonstrates the capability of robots to learn very specialized skill that takes people, you know, decades to master. And they require very fast reaction times. You know, table tennis requires that. Adapting to moving and changing environment very quickly at a level that is, you know, at expert level. So that is what's really exciting here. And there's a type of technology that this robot and many other more recent robots use that enables that. It's a stream of machine learning called reinforcement learning.
Give me the two-sentence summary, if you could, of what reinforcement learning is.
Yeah, so the idea is that before recently, we had to program robots to do specific things. We had to give them specific instructions to do it. And so a human is sort of doing that. But with reinforcement learning, which is essentially learning by trial and error, meaning that because you learned this skill by trying in different scenarios, you have been able to adapt to more scenarios than a human could have programmed you to do.
Would it be fair to say the advancements in robotics we're seeing are really advancements in AI?
Yeah. So for every robot system, we have like the mechanical, let's say the physical robot system has a mechanical component, and it also has like the intelligence, the ability for the robot to interact with its environment intelligibly. That is certainly all AI at the moment. AI is supercharging that capability for robots to have spatial understanding, know what's going on, and being able to predict how physics works, which is very hard. And we learned to do that over years and years. So AI is definitely enabling that to happen. And there are many applications in which we can see that people are feeling a bit safer, more comfortable to put robots into spaces that require higher levels of safety, because there's a bit more of a sense that robots can sort of adapt to uncertainty a bit better now.
What are the big barriers to robots being very useful day to day still?
That's a great question. A lot of the things that we are seeing in the news are mostly like really cool stunts, very exciting stuff, very exciting capabilities. But where robots are actually being used and creating value are in very niche environments, very specialized tasks. For example, Amazon Robotics, or Amazon broadly, has one of the largest deployments of robots doing warehouse fulfillment. It's very specialized, very well-defined, very controlled environments. And that's, robotics are doing pretty well there. When will robots come into our homes and do our dishes and help make our beds? And
This is my question. Yes. Tell me when.
Yes. When will robots do that? It's going to take a long time. It's going to take a long time, primarily because of robustness and safety. Wherever you see robots really making inroads, we have designed the environment to fit the capabilities of the robot. But I don't think you would be very excited to design your house to fit the capabilities of your floor cleaning robot. Mm. In spaces where robots have to adapt to the human environment, it's very challenging. And that is really where we're trying to, you know, make advancements in at the moment.
And I understand that like the dexterity of hands is a big problem with like humanoid robots. It is actually very hard to engineer a hand as good as a human hand. Is that right?
Yeah, that is right. That is, some people call that the holy grail of robotics, you know, manipulation, dexterity of human hand. Yes, that is a critical thing as well. That is like, okay, how could you actually get robots to effectively manipulate objects in a way that is even remotely similar or in certain level of performance as humans can. It's a mix of, can you build robot hands and fingers that have the kinds of dexterity as a human? Plus, can you build the software that allows robots to understand, process both visual and tactile sensing capabilities so the robots can actually know and get a sense of what it's doing with its hand? Those two things need to come together really well. And there are advancements in that space. It's very easy to build a robot hand that picks up one thing. It's hard to build a robot hand that picks up anything.
Mm-hmm. I understand another part of your work is getting kids interested in science, engineering, robotics, especially kids from Africa. Why is that a particular passion of yours?
A couple of reasons. The first is that I strongly believe in the power of technology in creating a better world. I believe that technology can serve as a tool to create value, real life value. And so my passion, originally being from Nigeria and continuing to have family there and deep ties and connections, I'm very passionate about seeing the future where the Global South is not just a consumer of technology, but helping shape it and helping, you know, define how it shapes its own society. And we only do that through educating people to know how to use these tools to create value in their communities.
Kene Mbanisi is Assistant Professor of Robotics Engineering at Olin College in Massachusetts.
I don't think robots will ever be able to make music like this.
This is the very first release by Senegalese supergroup Africando. The track dropped back in 1993, and it's called Guyagi. In the Wolof language, that's the name for baobab trees, giants found across Senegal.
The song's an homage to the baobab symbolism of longevity and wisdom. The late Medoun Diallo handles the vocals on this one. Africando formed in the 1990s, bringing together Senegalese vocalists who loved salsa with some of the musicians in New York City who developed the genre. The mix of Wolof with Spanish may have puzzled salsa fans at first, but Latin America totally embraced it and danced along.
Today, you are just as likely to find original Africando records in Colombia as in Senegal. The group doesn't tour anymore, but their music, it lives on.
So smooth. More global stories coming your way. Stay with us. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We're going to step back for the next few minutes to hear about the conundrum of plastic and what some countries are doing to confront it. Case in point, the European Union produces about 16 million tons of plastic packaging waste a year. Less than half of that is recycled. Investigative environmental journalists Lucy Taylor and Dan Ashby noticed something when they did their weekly shopping.
So, Dan, I've made a pile over here on the kitchen table. There's a lot of stuff here. Can you tell what all of these products have in common?
I mean, they're all wrapped in plastic, loads of plastic.
Yeah, and more than that, they're actually all wrapped in plastic packaging, which says, do not recycle on the label, or do not recycle at home.
To tackle this problem across Europe, new plants have been popping up, promising to handle this hard-to-recycle material using a technology called chemical or advanced recycling. Dan Ashby and Lucy Taylor from our partners at Deutsche Welle wanted to know if the technology actually lives up to its promise.
A lot of our food is wrapped in the types of plastic that are hard to recycle.
And all that packaging has to go somewhere when we're finished with it. Just as well, then, that the plastics industry is proposing a solution.
Advanced recycling, sometimes called chemical recycling, breaks down used plastics into their chemical building blocks.
Around the world and across Europe, companies are promising to take our bread wrappers and yogurt pots and recycle them differently. With substantial
carbon savings when compared. Chemical recycling essentially is very attractive because it expands by order of magnitude the potential of recycling.
This is Massimiliano Materazzi. He's Associate Professor of Chemical Engineering at the University College London. He's worked a lot with businesses, and he's trying to help us understand how chemical recycling works.
Chemical recycling technologies encompasses a quite wide range of different technologies which use, for example, heat or chemicals or even enzymes to break down these polymers into smaller components that then can be reused and reassembled.
Basically, he's saying chemical recycling is an umbrella term for anything that breaks down plastic into its original chemical building blocks to make new plastic all over again.
So to some extent, chemical recycling is true recycling in that you're turning waste back into the raw ingredients it was originally made from.
It's different from conventional recycling, which usually involves shredding plastics, but not changing it on a chemical level. Chemical recycling is designed to work on a wider range of plastics. And in theory, the chemical recycling process can be repeated again and again, turning our old, mixed, dirty plastic waste into shiny new plastic, and you can't even tell the difference. Which brings us back to our supermarket delivery.
So there's something else I've put in our shop this week that you might have noticed, because we don't usually buy it.
Three bars of chocolate.
Yes, these massive bars of chocolate. But they're not just a treat, there's a reason why I've bought them, and it's this note here on the wrapper saying that they're wrapped in 80% recycled plastic.
Okay, so that sounds good.
And the reason that's possible is because this company has started to use chemical recycling. And they say they're going to wrap 300 million bars a year in this recycled plastic.
And that sounds positive.
It's not just chocolate. Whatever you buy in the supermarket, you'll probably see something that's been recycled this way, from ice cream tubs to soft cheese. The European Union has even invested hundreds of millions of euros into chemical recycling projects. It's the new frontier of recycling. But not everyone believes it's the future. And experts and environmental organisations are lining up to highlight its flaws. So what's the truth about chemical recycling?
For the last year, Lucy and I have been working with a team of investigative journalists across Europe.
We're just waiting for Stefano.
We've been tracking the announcements of new chemical recycling plants in 9 European countries, and we've noticed something interesting. Of 78 new plants that were announced in the last few years, we found just 18 are now operating, and several of those are still in the pilot stage. More than 30 have been postponed or cancelled, and with others, there's no information at all. The original announcements and press releases promised, in total, that more than 2.5 million tons of plastic waste a year would be recycled, of about 16 million the EU produces each year. But our data suggests the real capacity of the plants that are operational so far is less than 10% of that.
We put this to the academic, Massimiliano Materazzi.
High energy cost has made this technology not, let's say, sufficiently competitive. It must also be said that the biggest enemy of recycled plastics will be virgin plastics, which as of today is still very cheap.
So chemical recycling is often expensive and uses a lot of energy. And it's competing with brand new plastic, often manufactured in China, which is typically much cheaper.
This is a kind of problem across all the recycling industry, not just chemical recycling. But yes, unfortunately, this is reflecting in the closure of many plants. And some projects which were promising of 300,000 tons of plastic waste over the coming years have been suspended until basically the market stabilizes and the process becomes economically competitive.
For all the industry promises, chemical recycling currently produces just 0.2% of Europe's total plastic.
We're not the only ones to notice this.
When you look at the projections of industry, asking yourself how much chemical recycling will we have in the future, the projections are all not met. They're not marginally not met. They are extremely badly not met.
Professor Dr. Helmut Maurer is a former senior expert of the Directorate General for Environment for the European Commission. He's become a vocal critic of chemical recycling.
I'm not saying that chemical recycling does not work. What I'm saying is it makes no sense. There's no environmental, economic, or whatever other advantage. And then the question again comes up, why the hell do you want to do this?
He believes the plastic industry is promoting chemical recycling and overselling its promise to make us feel better about using single-use plastics.
Chemical recycling tries to link to the overall recycling narrative. Recycling is associated with something good we do. We have a product that we use and it comes to its end of life, and then we put it into a process that makes it possible to dismantle it, to use parts of it, or to transform it, and to use it again and again. In reality, chemical recycling is not about recycling. It's about selling a narrative, the narrative of circularity of plastic.
The circularity of plastics. It's an idea we hear a lot from chemical recycling companies. The circular economy. In a world where plastic is piling up in our oceans, rivers, and soils, that's a tempting prospect. That our waste could be fed into a recycling plant and pop out the other end, ready to use again. But we want to know if it really works like that. How much of the plastic waste that goes in is actually being turned into new plastic?
What we found out is that chemical recycling is in fact very inefficient.
This is Yann Philippine, an investigative journalist for Mediapart in France and part of our team. He's been analysing documents, including some that weren't previously public, from one chemical recycling project in particular.
It's the first time ever that we could really prove the real efficiency or inefficiency of a process for a specific example and specific companies.
The project he looked at uses pyrolysis, which is the most widely used form of chemical recycling in Europe, breaking down plastic using heat.
It's a very complex process with a lot of different industrial steps. And to be simple, at each of these steps, there are losses.
He's found that it's not quite a perfect circle because the process creates other products as well as plastic. Some of these can be used as fuels or sold for other uses, but some are incinerated as waste.
What we discovered for a specific set of companies is that when you enter 100 kilos of plastic waste as input, at the end, you have only between 25 and 30% of it, which is going to become new plastic.
So just a quarter of the plastic waste that goes in becomes new plastic at the end. These are the figures for just one project, but Yann believes they're likely to be similar across the industry.
What is really interesting is that when we asked these companies to give us their figures, to give us the efficiency lead, none of them answered. And none of them publicly communicate about the efficiency of this process. And we can understand why, because if they would communicate honestly about it, it would be basically a catastrophe. Everybody would realize that it is very inefficient.
We put all this to Plastics Europe, a trade association that represents plastics manufacturers. They told us that without chemical recycling, hard-to-recycle plastics will either be exported, incinerated, or sent to landfill, with all the associated negative environmental consequences, and that real progress is being made in developing the technology to improve processes.
But is it better to recycle some plastic than none at all? Our team was taking this all in when we came across someone online with an unusual disclaimer in his bio.
Hi, I'm Tom Blocker, unapologetic promoter of chemical recycling on the one hand, advocate for transparency regarding its limitations on the other.
Tom Blocker works for Bus Chemtech, a chemical firm based in Switzerland. He's spearheading the launch of chemical recycling at his company, and he says it's made him feel good, like he's putting something positive into the world. But about a year ago, he decided to take the wider industry to task.
I was a little nervous. The message, I have no problem with.
He'd heard some of the criticisms of the chemical recycling industry, and they resonated.
We talked about it, the false claims, bad claims, inflated claims, which have led to canceled projects, delayed projects, investments going down the drain because of bankruptcy. We as an industry were too quick to claim to be the solution to the problem.
He's not just posting his thoughts on LinkedIn. He's spoken at conferences.
I called him out and I said, hey, we are part of our problem and we need to stop. We need to start taking responsibility for the limitations of our technology, for being open and transparent. Not just about, hey, how great we are, but also, hey, what are the limitations? Where are the things we still need to work on and all of that?
Tom Blocker acknowledges that chemical recycling plants often aren't as efficient as they'd like to be, and that making the industry commercially viable at scale is a challenge. But despite all that, he says he still believes it's worthwhile.
Probably chemical recycling, pyrolysis in particular, was used by certain actors in the industry to distract. I'm sure that there are petrochemical companies that 10 years ago, 15 years ago, or even 5 years ago, used the promise of recycling of plastics to distract away from the fact that they're increasing their plastic production globally. However, you cannot make that blanket statement. Chemical recycling is taking a certain volume of plastics that are difficult or impossible to recycle, mechanically recycle, as opposed to being burned in an incinerator.
So, in Thomas's view, no, chemical recycling is not perfect yet, but it's filling an important gap. And he says the industry is still in its infancy. Give it time. Professor Dr. Helmut Maurer said one more thing that gave us pause. That chemical recycling could actually lead to more plastic being produced overall, not less. Because the pyrolysis process requires such a high proportion of virgin hydrocarbons, it could actually increase the amount of virgin materials produced overall.
Because all the argument around plastic from the industry has only one objective: securing the production, I would say the global overproduction, of plastics.
We wanted to ask the industry about this, so journalist Ludovica Jona, who's also part of our investigation, met with Alexander Ruder from Plastics Europe, which supports the European plastic sector.
Do you expect that chemical recycling of plastic will also bring an increase in sales of European plastic producers?
We do not see this necessarily as a way to boost our business, but rather as a necessity to decarbonize our sector.
Do you expect an increase of sales? Yes or not?
That will depend a lot on the regulatory framework. One thing that we see as a sector is that it will not increase total demand for plastics.
When you put pyrolysis oil in the cracker, there is 5% pyrolysis oil, 95% virgin oil. So if we have to increase chemical recycling of plastic, we'll also increase the use of virgin plastic.
No, not necessarily. No, this fraction of 5% to 95% is not a set fraction. We have 5%. In some cases, yes, it can be the quality of the pyrolysis oil, but you can upgrade the pyrolysis oil and then you can go to higher fractions.
How much higher?
In theory, you can go to 100%. It depends on the quality of the pyrolysis oil.
But yeah, in fact, we have to admit that at this moment, the percentage of pyrolysis oil in a cracker can range from 5 to 10%. The rest, it's going to be virgin plastic. So at the current moment, an increase of chemical recycling means an increase of plastic production.
No, not necessarily.
We followed up by email, and Plastics Europe gave us one example of a pilot facility using 100% pyrolysis oil from plastic waste.
It's an industry that divides opinion. energy intensive, expensive, and perhaps inefficient on the one hand, and yet somehow, perhaps still the best chance we have of recycling some plastics which currently go into landfill or go up in smoke in incinerators, taking them out of the supply chain altogether. Our team's analysis suggests that the European Union has invested at least 760 million euros in chemical recycling via public subsidies and investments. But almost everyone agrees that conventional mechanical recycling, where plastic is shredded, is best where it's possible. And not using single-use plastics in the first place is even better. At its core, recycling represents the idea of a circle, something being used again and again. But perhaps the only cycle of the last 50 years has been the creation of more and more plastic. You'd be forgiven for thinking the circular economy feels far off. And right now, we're going in circles instead.
That report came from our partners at DW and was funded by the Investigative Journalism for Europe Fund.
Still to come on the show, every April, 2,000 people flock to a remote estate in England for one reason, homemade marmalade. And no, that's not the same as jam. I'll pretend I didn't hear that. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. King Charles is in Washington today trying to leverage the influence of the crown in front of Congress. But British influence is as much about culture and history as it is about government or the monarchy. For a taste of iconic Britishness, reporter Leo Hornack went to a remote country house in England over the weekend for a festival that celebrates a prized condiment.
Do you hear that? That metallic tinkling? Every single clatter is the sound of a small metal tasting spoon being thrown aside after delivering yet another delicious, tangy sample of something very British, homemade marmalade. I'm making a radio programme about the festival for American radio. What have you just tasted?
I've tasted ruby grapefruit marmalade with snow fungus and dried logan. It's absolutely delicious. Get yourself over from the USA to come and taste these lovely things.
I'm standing inside a packed marquee in the grounds of a remote medieval country house in northern England. And in front of us are long, long tables laden with hundreds and hundreds of pots of homemade marmalade, each one a contestant in the ultimate breakfast condiment competition. The Dalemaine International Marmalade Contest, the Olympics of Marmalade. And for me and the other 2,000 or so visitors here today, the rules are strict. Each member of the public is permitted just one spoonful from each jar, no matter how delicious.
I've been on this one table for half an hour, I can't move anywhere.
So how many have you tasted?
Already about 30. It's quintessential, it really is, it's lovely.
For many people, breakfast isn't breakfast without the bittersweet, sour taste of marmalade. For traditionalists, there are only three ingredients: water, sugar, and the uniquely sharp oranges from Seville in Spain. And it's not just the juice of the oranges, the whole fruit, flesh, and skin goes in. The skin is what gives marmalade its unique, complex bitterness. Some would say it's an acquired taste. Not easy to adjust to if you're used to commercial jelly. And like everyone here, Paul Osborne has his own vision for what makes a great marmalade.
I just tried the lemon, honey and ginger. That's a really good one.
And people politely jostling for the best
ones. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You have to get your elbows out every now and again, especially with the old ladies.
I'm here with a very definite goal, to taste the medal winner of medal winners, the finest marmalade in the world.
Welcome to Dalemaine and welcome to Cumbria. For anyone who doesn't live here, this is what it's like all the time.
Out on the carefully manicured lawn in front of Dalemaine Manor, the prize ceremony is beginning. Picture Downton Abbey, but with a far greater emphasis on citrus fruits. Many in the crowds here are wearing orange hats, shirts, dresses. Even the flock of sheep on nearby hills have been dyed orange for the weekend.
A nice slice of toast.
Local kids from Staten Primary School have even composed a hymn to Marmalade to make sure we stay properly focused on the subject. Prize categories include traditional marmalades, marmalades with alcohol, interesting additional ingredient marmalades. There is even a prize for marmalades made by people serving time in prison. They are generally not able to attend the ceremony.
I'd like to welcome Her Excellency, the Spanish Ambassador to the UK, Mrs. Emma Aparici.
And if this seems a very British affair, it is also explicitly about bringing different cultures together. This year, entries were received from more than 25 countries, ranging from Botswana to Georgia to Taiwan. In the Japanese town of Yawatahama, a sister marmalade festival has now been launched. One Japanese marmalade master this year swept the British event with 8 medals. Beatrice Hassel-McCosh is the director of the whole event and took over from her mother a few years ago. And Beatrice isn't new to the area. Her family have owned and lived in Dalmain Manor since 1679.
I think marmalade brings joy is the message.
She has the cheerful evangelical belief that there's no such thing as someone who doesn't like marmalade. Just people who haven't yet tasted the right one or haven't spread enough of it on the right food.
Marmalade can be eaten with absolutely anything, so we'd really, if you don't like it on toast or if you don't think it's a breakfast thing, have it with sausages or have it with ham.
Back when Beatrice was a child, there was a worrying story in the British press that Nutella and peanut butter sales had for the first time exceeded marmalade. Beatrice's mother was determined not to let this pass and founded the contest, with the proceeds going to charity. And it has exploded since then.
So we have 3,400 entries this year. Every single day in January we get about 200 parcels and there's about 60 judges.
Beatrice is one of the judges representing the family. Marathon tasting sessions take place inside the grand family home.
So you can immediately tell when something's a gold, and in the judging room when a gold is announced, so everyone dings their glass and everyone cheers, and then usually they pass them round the room because everyone wants to taste it.
So now, obviously the most important question I'm going to ask, what makes a good marmalade for you?
It's fresh fruit, creativity. You just have no idea when you open the jars what's going to happen. Yeah, the Spanish ambassador yesterday described it as tasting fine wine.
Back in the tent, this year's Gold of Gold medals has been announced. The winner is Seville Orange with Passion Fruit Marmalade, made by veteran competitor David Hinkins.
I've had to sign a non-disclosure agreement, so I cannot make it or give anybody the recipe for 12 months.
It's been a hard road. David's won medals before, but never the double gold. But he's never given up hope.
11 years of pain, 11 years of work making marmalade and sending it up here, you know. Second is nowhere in some respects, isn't it?
Victory was based on a single last-minute decision.
At the end of making it, I actually thought, I'm going to put more passion fruit in, and it's clearly it worked and I've won. Fortune does favour the brave.
So I'm now approaching, this is the Mount Olympus of marmalade, really. This is the table where this year's winner, the Dalmain World Marmalade Awards Best in Show 2026, a marmalade created by Mr. David Hinkins. You have to queue up to taste it. And I'm getting a very generous spoon. And here we go. Wow. I can say I've tasted the best marmalade in the world now. That is an amazing marmalade. I think I'm going to buy a jar of that.
For the world, I'm Leo Hornack, Cumbria, in England.
Yeah, he's not sharing. The World comes to you every weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening and join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life.
LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Renee Vacchio Albi, Roman Mars, the Kelsen Foundation, and the Ken and Lucy Lehman family. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.